The following talk was recorded at LibrePlanet 2021 Empowering Users, the annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. LibrePlanet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libreplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. LibrePlanet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their use of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take positions on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the grievance of all computer users, LibrePlanet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss, and for more information on LibrePlanet, you can visit libreplanet.org/conference.
And you go.
Welcome back again, everybody. This is LibrePlanet 2021, and we are again with a great speaker with a great topic today. And Connor will be our guest, and he will be presenting his talk about SecureDrop and new implementation SecureDrop workstation. And as he told me earlier, it's a continuation of the security project that has been just presented in the 2017 LibrePlanet and awarded for the job. And I'm really excited to hear what he's going to say, because that's a project that I use, that I teach, that I recommend people. And it's a wonderful thing for the whole humanity to have such software in their arsenal to just defend ourselves. So, I'm not going to chatter along, and Connor can just fill you in his topic a lot better than I am. Connor, great to have you here. Stage is yours.
Al, thank you so much for the introduction. Very kind words. It's excellent to be back at LibrePlanet, remote or otherwise. Thanks so much for your hard work putting this together. As Al mentioned, we did present on SecureDrop as a platform back at the 2017 LibrePlanet. In 2016, SecureDrop was honored by the Free Software Foundation with an award for a project of social benefit. So what I'm here to talk about today, I will give a lot of context for what SecureDrop as a project is today, what it's grown into. But mostly, I want to talk about a continuation of the work, the next generation architecture, so to speak, which we are calling the SecureDrop Workstation. One of the core goals here is that we can allow journalists, particularly investigative journalists, to open submissions and handle documents in a safe manner when that's quite a risky operation by its nature. So to give you an impression about how this talk is structured, what I'm going to go through today, first, I'm going to give you a bit of a high-level overview about the organization that I work for, which is Freedom of the Press Foundation, sort of the way we approach our work in supporting journalists and other press freedom issues, and some various initiatives that we have to sort of explain the context in which we operate and why SecureDrop remains a fundamental project in the press freedom work that we do. Then I'll explain SecureDrop, which is a long-running standard solution used by many newsrooms around the world in very sensitive investigative contexts. So I'll explain how that project works, how it operates, why it's been successful, and then also cue up some of its shortcomings, some of its rough edges that have motivated our continued work on what we are now calling today the SecureDrop Workstation. That's really the main course of the presentation. In order to understand how the SecureDrop Workstation operates, I will be explaining some of its fundamental dependencies, particularly Cubes, which is an operating system that is geared toward a high security computing environment. I'll explain how that works. I'll talk about who's currently using the workstation. I will even draw a reference to a recent security audit that we put the workstation through, and then talk about what our future work looks like. So, Freedom of the Press Foundation, that is the nonprofit that employs me, as well as the entire SecureDrop team to date. FPF was founded about 8 years ago. I've been with the organization for 6 years now. Broadly speaking, we aim to empower investigative journalists, people that are doing the aggressive, the risky reporting. Those are the folks that we want to find, identify, and help. A big part of that is understanding the risks that they face. So as our organization tries to broaden press freedoms, both in the United States and around the world, we take a variety of approaches to do that. So first and foremost is news and advocacy, right? You can see four little categories at the bottom of this slide. The advocacy part is basically shaping the message, you know, explaining the importance of investigative journalism, why press freedoms are fundamental to a democratic society, part of why I'm here today to give a talk to explain how pressing these issues are. Another venue that we take is the Press Freedom Tracker. This is a more recent project launched a little over 2 years ago. And that is investigating the current state of play and trying to quantify the data around violations of press freedom. I'll explain a little bit more about that in a moment. Then we also have digital security. These are folks that actually partner with journalists in the field. And then lastly, SecureDrop, which is our flagship engineering project. If nothing fits the bill that our trainers and our security experts can recommend for journalists or for a newsroom, then we turn to our engineering team, which will develop a bespoke solution. By far, our most popular to date has been SecureDrop, and more recently, the SecureDrop Workstation addition to it. So I mentioned the US Press Freedom Tracker project. Again, started about 2.5 years ago. This was in partnership with the Committee to Protect Journalists. The goal here is to document violations of press freedom, specifically in the United States, simply because our team doesn't have the bandwidth to do that globally. To date, we've developed a rubric that will classify any press freedom violation into a variety of different categories and attributes for the event. So it could be a physical assault against a journalist. It could be a denial of access. Perhaps someone in a privileged position denied a journalist entry to a room, to a public event where they could have been recorded or asked questions of. So our team has a broad rubric to classify all these events. Some of the stats that I'm showing on the screen now are actually old. These are from last year. The team is still working through a backlog of cases reported in 2020, starting with the George Floyd protests and then moving on throughout the year. We saw more press freedom violations, meaning incidences of assault, destruction of equipment, seizure of equipment, denial of access, chilling statements, those types of things. We saw vastly more in 2020 than we had in 2019. And in 2019, we saw more than we'd seen in 2018. So this is something that we'll continue to keep tabs on. We've already seen the data that the Press Freedom Tracker collates cited in legislation, both at the federal and local level in the United States. So we're very proud of this project. The team is working very hard. And additionally, there's a public data set. So if you are so inclined, you can filter that data yourself, export all of it. And we're actively working on improving visualizations and accessibility for that data. Another prong of the work that we do at Freedom of the Press Foundation is our team of digital security trainers. These are the folks that work most directly with journalists, not just journalists in the traditional context, working for a newspaper or a newsroom. This also includes filmmakers, documentarians, basically anyone who's trying to tell a story and is sensitive to the identities or the risks that the sources, the people they are working with to tell their story, any dangers that they might have in working with the journalists. So this often involves understanding pretty intimately what the given workflow of a team is. So pre-pandemic, our team was constantly on the road, traveling, working with these people. Now we've switched to a much more remote consultation type format where we can understand the workflows, the challenges that they face in that specific environment, performing those specific tasks, and then make recommendations for how to improve source security. As a simple example on how important threat modeling can be, understanding the situation. If a journalist is perhaps traveling across an international border and then recording interviews with sources who should not be identified by that local government, and then transporting that recorded material back across a border checkpoint, you know, there are some recommendations we can make, such as make sure to encrypt all of that information at rest, or perhaps exfiltrate it over the network and then wipe your local drives before passing through that checkpoint. That might be a useful recommendation for certain contexts, but if you're working in Los Angeles or Hollywood on a film, then maybe cybersecurity is a much bigger threat to you. So we will work, our folks will build a recommendation plan. We do have the ability to request access to our team on the website. If you or anyone you know needs that type of dedicated security consultation, please reach out. This team has also been an invaluable funnel of information on the ground. From the way journalists work that we can then pretty quickly apply in our engineering context and also in our advocacy and outreach. So is this has very much been the lifeline of understanding what the current threats are and shaping our strategy around what tools we can build to empower these folks doing dangerous work. And then that last point, the engineering projects, the bespoke tasks that we'll build because nothing exists to fill the space. So today I'm going to talk a lot about SecureDrop and additionally this SecureDrop workstation component. So as background, what SecureDrop is and what it does today, it is an online whistleblowing platform. It's hosted on-premise, meaning installed on hardware inside news organizations. We at FPF do not run the servers for SecureDrop. Every news organization that uses SecureDrop runs their own server on hardware. That distribution makes it a lot more resilient because there is no one SecureDrop to attack, and there is certainly no one SecureDrop to shut down. The way SecureDrop works is it makes use of Tor Onion services. These provide anonymity, and it makes use of GPG for encryption so that anything sent to the system is safely encrypted for later review by a journalist. And of course, given that we're presenting here at LibrePlanet, I will point out that all of the code that we write is free software, the vast majority of which is licensed under the AGPL. Here's a list of news organizations that are currently running SecureDrop. It runs the gamut. A lot of the work that FPF does has traditionally been North American focused, but within the past several years, we've worked very hard with the team and with the community, particularly with Localization Lab, to localize and internationalize the interface for SecureDrop. So it's gained a substantial following around the world. You'll see a lot of non-Western media outlets here. Basically, what SecureDrop has become is the gold standard in secure source communications. That's what we're seeing happen here. So I want to explain a little bit of context and some of the motivations for SecureDrop. Having explained a little bit of the landscape about press freedom threats, both in the United States and globally, it makes sense to rationalize why we as a nonprofit are investing in maintaining this open source and free software project. It's a tall order for a small nonprofit, but it's very important that we continue to do this. Point number one, all of the work the journalists do is risky by nature, right? I still remember very clearly speaking directly with a journalist. We've probably all been through anti-phishing training. In other words, be very careful when you're opening an email, make sure that the URL really goes where you think, and think before you click is a common adage for security trainers. And I had a journalist sort of stop mid-workshop and say, hold on, that's literally my job, is to click on things that people send me. I must do that. Tell me how to do it safely. I recognize that's a need. I want to protect the people that I'm working with and I want to protect myself, but you have to show me how to do it safely because I have to do it. That conversation always stayed with me because these people have needs in computing and they are trying to help the society that they live in. And so we as technologists and as activists are on deck to basically explain how this can be possible. And if it's not possible by what we have today putting together, well, then we have to build something better. That's something we've tried to do with SecureDrop Workstation. So some of the example stories I've put here on the slide for illustrations purposes are examples about mostly nation state sponsored malware. In various places around the world, governments are paying top dollar to buy or write exploits, and then using those exploits to target journalists, because journalists are very often engaged in activities that question and challenge power and authority. There was a famous example of even Jeff Bezos, one of the richest people in the world, had his cell phone hacked, allegedly, by the Saudi government. And it looks like the vector for that attack was a simple media message that was sent over an encrypted WhatsApp text message. And opening, playing that video, compromised the phone. So as journalists are working with people that maybe are anonymous to varying degrees, they must look at the materials that are sent to them. How can they do that safely? Simply clicking on every link that you get on your laptop or on your cell phone clearly is not enough of a security baseline for an investigative reporter. How can we do better than that? Additional motivation. Journalists certainly take on a lot of risk in the work that they do, but they have all sorts of things working in their favor. Nonprofits like us, the institutions that fund them, the enterprise that they may be working for. Sources, on the other hand, often lack that same representation and institutional support. By virtue of the act of blowing the whistle, somebody is very often putting their livelihood on the line and perhaps even their life on the line. What we do at FBF is designed to ensure that a source that is making the decision to blow the whistle can do so anonymously. Well, one way to think about this is not every source is Ed Snowden, right? It doesn't mean that they don't all have extremely important things to say, but one thing that let Edward Snowden be successful in some of the leaks that he did was the incredible amount of technical expertise that he had in coming forward, right? He was able to evade the NSA for a while until he went public. He was able to get sensitive information directly to journalists by using proxies and Tor and SSH and all these technologies that he was comfortable with and had to explain to people working with him how to use. But we can't expect that from every source, right? So what we're trying to do with SecureDrop and other initiatives is to ensure that the baseline, the default, is something that is anonymous and safe to use. I'll talk in more detail about how that works in SecureDrop, but it's always been a goal for us because we want to allow people the choice to speak out without jeopardizing their career by having said something to a journalist. Last point I'll make on the motivations here. After the Snowden revelations, we saw a plethora of secure tip line reporting solutions that were growing like spring flowers all across the media landscape. And more often than not, they were custom solutions. Somebody said, hey, we need to figure out a way to do this safely. We'll write our own. I can remember way back in 2015 and 2016, there were a variety of solutions that didn't even use HTTPS on the web form. A lot has changed in the internet landscape since then, thankfully. But what we want to make sure is that anyone who needs to do the secure communication can point to a well-reviewed solution to do it. So rather than every single newsroom out there developing their own custom solution for how to handle documents securely, what we've opted to do as a nonprofit is develop and maintain a solution, train people, document that very well, train people on how to use it, and then that can become a standard of sorts that both journalists are familiar working with and also sources understand how they operate. They can come to the table with expectations around how their communications with the news organization will be handled. Right out of the gate, using SecureDrop, a source is completely anonymous. They're using a Tor URL and a randomly generated username. They did not have to divulge anything that is potentially personally identifying, such as an email address to make an account or a cell phone number to use a text messaging-based tip line. None of that is included in SecureDrop by design. And this also means that as a free software project, we can send this off to external auditors, security auditors, penetration testers, and they can review the software, recommend improvements, and then we publish the results of those audits. I'll touch more on that point later today as well. And the last point I'll make here is that not every newsroom can afford a team to work on a solution like this. Some newsrooms can, I'll point that out, but all newsrooms should be drawing on the benefit of technology like this, and free software allows us to do that. So if we make an improvement that we've seen several different groups of journalists request or otherwise require, once we add that to the software stack that is SecureDrop, everyone running SecureDrop gets that benefit. And we've seen that really increase adoption speed over the past couple of years. Again, this is becoming the standard for how newsrooms will operate when handling sensitive source material and communication. And now this is something that every time we make an improvement, everybody gets it for free, as it were, free as in free software. Now I'm gonna explain a little bit about how SecureDrop works, okay? This is still the preface to what I ultimately wanna talk about today, which is the workstation. But in order to understand how that fits into the picture, it's important to understand how SecureDrop operates and is used in the real world. So right here, I have a small architecture diagram showing a few different pieces of hardware. This is what is hosted on-premise inside the news organizations. So at the very top, you see two different servers. There's an application server. That's what's actually hosting the code that creates the interface and handles the submissions. So these are Python Flask web applications. There are two different web interfaces, both served over Tor Onion URLs. The first one is this, what we call the source interface. This is the public door to a SecureDrop. Absolutely anyone in the world, provided they've installed a Tor browser, can access that, create an account, and then communicate with journalists at that news organization. There's a separate Onion URL that is private and authenticated. And that is the interface that journalists inside the news organization connect to in order to access submissions and download things that were sent by sources during their correspondence. I do want to highlight that it's a rather uncommonly known feature of Onion URLs. A Tor Onion service can be authenticated, which means it, it requires additional key-based authentication even to resolve that onion URL. We make heavy use of this in secure job contexts because it means no one in the outside world can even attempt to log in to a journalist account on SecureDrop because they cannot even resolve that onion URL without the private key-based information to connect. Once they've made that connection, of course, there are additional authentication walls. But this is what the source sees when they access that source interface, that web application. It's basically a landing page inside of Tor browser. They don't have Tor browser, they can't even get this far. So right out of the gate, the source is required to be anonymous online in order to use SecureDrop. You can see on the left, get started. That's the workflow for registering an account and then starting to send material in right away. If you have previously visited this organization's SecureDrop, then you would mark yourself as a return visit, authenticate, and continue an ongoing discussion there. Back to the list of servers. I mentioned the application server that's running that source interface and the journalist interface. We also have a separate hardware box that is playing the role of a monitor server. This is for internal use at the newsroom. This server will monitor, observe conditions on the application server. And in the event that something is not operating quite as it should, it will send alerts to the newsroom's administrator so that they can take action. Maybe an upgrade needs to be manually applied. There are a variety of conditions that we at FPF and our SecureDrop maintainer team, we can add rule sets that might be conditions that would be worthy of raising alert to an administrator. And that's the platform we use to do that. So between outside the two servers, we mandate the use of a dedicated hardware firewall. The goal of this is to completely separate the SecureDrop installation from anything else that the newsroom may be running already. So because this is hosted on-premise, it might be in a server room with a variety of other machines that the news organization is using to host websites or other services, but we want to make sure that SecureDrop remains entirely separate from that. It doesn't reuse any logins or other information. It is a standalone application, and this hardware firewall provides full segmentation at the network level for that application. Now, it's important to highlight that this hardware firewall, given our heavy use of Tor and specifically onion services, it drops all incoming traffic. So usually when you configure a web server, you're going to open up a few ports so that people requesting access to that web server can actually get information out of it. That's not how SecureDrop works. We drop all traffic coming in, except for established related on a stateful firewall, because onion services provide NAT punching for free. That's an unfamiliar term. It basically means that Tor services can connect outside from a private network and handle connections even when there's a firewall in front of it. It's a very useful feature, and we use it extensively in SecureDrop, but it also has a variety of other applications for smaller even home computing use. Happy to provide further detail on that during Q&A if anyone is interested. So this application server, when a source comes along and has something to say, that might be text that they type, it might be a file that they upload, that submission is going to be encrypted on the fly by the application server. So the application server has the public key of a key pair, and it will encrypt on the fly, meaning it will encrypt it in memory before it even writes anything to disk. So by the time any information a source has sent is written to the server's permanent storage, it is already encrypted. And that private key does not exist on the server. So that means that even in a raid, if this server hardware were taken, all the information in the database around source comms are going to be completely encrypted. So it's not useful when we're trying to obscure the forensic utility of performing a raid on a SecureDrop instance. Now, in order to actually read these submissions, though, at some point the journalist has to access it and they're going to need to decrypt it. So today, this is what the workflow is for classic SecureDrop. I'm going to show a revised version of this that is supported by the workstation in a moment. So today, a journalist will use a dedicated laptop and boot into the Tails operating system, which is based on a USB drive. It is an ephemeral operating system in large part, meaning that when you shut it down, everything is wiped. It also has an optional feature to store a persistence volume inside of that USB stick encrypted so that long-term secrets such as authentication details, for example, to a SecureDrop journalist interface can be stored and accessed later. The journalist boots into that Tails environment, and this is what they see. If they access that web application in Tor browser, they can see some submissions from sources, but they can't actually view those submissions yet. They can see that they came in and they can download them, but remember, they're still encrypted, and the journalist at this point in the process doesn't have any key material to perform that decryption. So what the journals will do is download that information locally, and then they will transfer that via a USB stick to a secure viewing station, the SVS acronym on that laptop. The secure viewing station is air-gapped. A little sneaker symbol next to the USB stick is illustrating that the journalist must physically transport this information away from one computer and plug it into another computer. The private key material for decrypting these submissions exists on the air gap. And that is where the journalist will perform the decryption, review the material that the source sent, and then decide what action to take after that. The action they decide to take might be write back to the source, ask clarifying questions, or it might be, hey, this is really useful information. I would like to share this with other members of my investigative team. And then we switch to the export workflow. Still, even today in 2021, a common workflow is to print out a document that has been sent, which has the remarkable property of disassociating a lot of metadata from a document. If you print it, all that metadata on authorship is not any longer a part of that document. And newsrooms are very well equipped in secure document destruction procedures. As we train them on digital security techniques, some of that applies and some of it not so much, but this is a workflow that many are familiar with and does provide a number of interesting security controls. So this process here, this whole journalist workflow, is what I'm really going to dive into today, because that's a little complex, frankly. This area in the red box, those are all the steps that a journalist needs to take in order to use SecureDrop. What I'm going to show you today as part of this workstation project is a consolidated workflow. Far fewer steps, far less error prone, and most importantly, still provides the same security baseline that we've so long striven for in the SecureDrop project. So, enter the workstation. The motivations here, again, that cumbersome workflow is sort of feels one way in many respects. A source will talk to a journalist, send some information. A journalist needs to run through several manual steps, explain then back to the source what sort of clarifying material they need, but they're already 45 minutes separated from having actually accessed that and decrypted it and done everything. So what we'd like to restore is a bit of a two-way, a conversational approach, so that side by side, the journalist can review material as it's coming in and ask clarifying questions in the moment. That's been a fundamental goal of the project. The success of SecureDrop by and large has been how simple the experience has been for the source. As long as you have Tor browser running, it's a cinch to use. That's all you need. But one of the ways we achieved that simplicity on the source side was by sweeping a lot of the complexity behind the curtain, so to speak, and forcing journalists and also the administrators within the news organization to deal with that operational complexity. That's something we're now trying to refine and respect the demands of a high-paced newsroom in the 21st century, and the workstation is allowing us to make headway on that problem. Another motivation. Patching an air gap system is quite hard. So remember, air gap means there's no network connection whatsoever. That's where the private key material is stored for a SecureDrop instance. The reason we air gap that is because it's incredibly important, sensitive material. Anyone who has that private key can decrypt documents that were sent to a given SecureDrop. Well, the fact that it's air gapped means that bad things can't easily get in. And if bad things somehow did get in, they can't get out. That's the goal of the air gap, to isolate, to confine. But that also means that we can't easily make changes to that environment. So we can't patch it easily. That means applying security updates. Security patches are something that we want to make sure always land on time. It's a challenging workflow to patch an air-gapped environment. But also, we just can't make any changes whatsoever. So if we want to improve the usability of tooling or maybe provide some additional software so that journalists can perform some analysis in that air-gapped environment, we don't have the ability to do so. That's been a core motivation of the workstation project. Additionally, that air gap, although it sounds like it's doing very important work, segmenting everything from the rest of a news organization's network or from the internet at large, it's not perfect isolation. In fact, we can do better, and the workstation does do better. Although it's isolated from a variety of network contexts, there are still overlapping trust domains within the air gap. For example, the private key material, which is highly sensitive, and a source's submission, which is ultimately untrusted material. Those both exist on the air gap station in order to decrypt the documents. The fact that those two trust domains overlap is, to put it lightly, inelegant. We can do better, and we can separate those concerns much more strongly and thereby reinforce some of the security expectations that we have. And finally, as I alluded to earlier, SecureDrop, after everything, all the steps are performed, a journalist has this material, but then what, right? What's the next step? Having had the sensitive anonymous correspondence with a sensitive source, and now actually having the material, what do I do with it from here is a question we often get. And to date, that's something that our digital security training team has always stepped in on. They'll train on workflows for what to do with that stuff. If you, depending on what sort of submission you receive, there are different procedures that might be appropriate. But for example, in an image file, there could be GPS coordinates. We've seen examples of sources' anonymity get burned when a journalist took a photo and then uploaded it to the news organization's website, and nobody in between thought to examine the EXIF data on that image file. And so people who read the news article were able to inspect that same unredacted metadata in the image, find GPS coordinates, and then know exactly where the source was hiding. That's the kind of thing that our digital security trainers will explain and advise on workflows for. As a result of years of work, we're hoping maybe to operationalize those workflows into pipelines that we can deploy in the workstation. So now I'm going to explain some of the inner workings of the workstation. To do that, I'm going to explain how one of its foundational dependencies works. There is a free software project called the Cubes operating system. The workstation leverages Cubes in order to have a high security computing environment that is appropriate for journalists. So what we want to do here is basically provide full isolation. I'm going to walk through an architecture diagram and show you how this works. But basically the technology that's being deployed here is a Zen hypervisor. This is the same thing that Amazon uses when they run computers in the cloud. You pay $5 a month for a server. I pay $5 a month for a server. Our computers should not be able to read each other's information. Amazon uses specifically Zen, actually, in order to separate those computing contexts. Cube says, why not use that state-of-the-art isolation technology for all of the computing applications that you do on your laptop? So to build up here, I'll run through how Cubes works and then revisit this in the context of the workstation specifically. At the very bottom of the stack, we have the hardware, right? This is the actual metal and silicon that makes up the computer. So in this case, a laptop, a Lenovo ThinkPad would work just fine. That's what I'm using to give this presentation on. I'm running Cubes OS right now, and that's a foundational layer. On top of that, we will install Zen. This is the hypervisor, the distribution that is used in order to manage how the computer operates. The first piece of managing all these different parts on the computer is domain zero or DOM zero. This is Fedora based, doesn't technically need to be, but in Cubes it's Fedora based. And this is the super user environment, the root context. And it's the most privileged space, and it determines how all the other components of the system are permitted to operate together. One of the building blocks that Cubes provides for us is a template VM. This is a known reliable source, such as Debian Stable, and other contexts can be instantiated from that. So there are various forms that components on Cubes can take. An app VM will be based on a template VM, and it can store its own private material, but only in very select ways. And then it will be reset to the context of the template VM. So you can install new software in there, you can do a whole bunch of different operations, but it will always fall back to its identity as a template VM. We have a disposable VM, which has all sorts of great properties in the context of investigative journalism. This VM will be destroyed completely when it is closed. So it's copied from the template VM, so it's got predictable contents, but then after it's been used, it is completely destroyed. And then we can have a vault VM, which is essentially a VM with absolutely no knowledge of any network connectivity. So the VM doesn't even have a network interface assigned to it. So you can still store files in there and, you know, use applications, but it can't talk anywhere out on the network. And because these are all building blocks, we can mix and match. For example, we can have a disk VM with no network connectivity. These are tools that Cubes allows us to put together into a more complex system. And then there are a few different components that Cubes provides out of the box. A networking VM, this is what actually stores the drivers for network hardware. That's separate from the rest of the computer. This is what will interface with the raw hardware, an Ethernet card, a Wi-Fi connection. Behind that is a VM to apply firewall rules. That's happening separately from the network exposed VM that could potentially be compromised if you were exposed to malware. The firewall VM happens inside of that, and there's an additional component managing USB connections. Top of all this, Cubes gives us the ability. Zen has a capability called VChan. Cubes calls their implementation an extension of that QREXEC, Cubes Remote Execution. And this allows a policymaker, so in this context, us maintaining the software, we can declare explicit allow lists for conditions whereby VMs are allowed to exchange information with each other of certain types, provided certain information is met. Now, the way this works in the SecureDrop workstation architecture, this is the consolidated workflow. I'll run through that same architecture diagram and explain the components that we are using to bring to bear. And we have the SysNet at the top, ultimately going toward an internet connection at the bottom, right? The firewall will filter out any incoming connections. Then we have a Tor VM that is managing connection to the Onion service. That is green because it has a network attached to it. We then have a proxy VM. This is running a custom Python application that performs allowed actions via the Tor network connection, okay? So this proxy VM serves the role of basically gating what is a permissible operation for the journalist to perform in the context of the trusted environment. This red box is a vault, non-networked environment. This is actually where the interface runs that a journalist interacts with. So this is where they see their source information. Critically, that component has no direct network access. So nothing inside that VM context can talk to the network. What it is permitted to talk to via QR exec is our dedicated proxy, which will handle requests that are API compliant and then pass those on to the SecureDrop server that is hosted in the newsroom. Also, this vault setup allows us to isolate the key material. So that GPG private key is now in a different context, also no network access. And due to an explicit policy grant that we've made in the architecture, only the GUI application the journalist uses is permitted to request ad hoc decryption of material. But it is not permitted, for example, to exfiltrate the key material. Can't ever get the raw key back, but it can request that the service VM perform decryptions on its behalf. No other area on the system, such as the system firewall, is permitted to make those calls to the private key material. So finally, last piece here is the disposable vault setup. Now that the journalist has actually viewed things, or received things rather, how do they view them? That is a disposable environment. So because we're not quite sure, right, about the provenance of that material, given that it was anonymously sent, and given that journalists have inherently risky jobs, we want to make sure that that material can be disposed of safely after it's been viewed. And we want to make sure it has no access to any other sensitive information on the system. This also allows us to have a whole medley of file support. So we can do, you know, rich video, audio, office documents, pretty much anything that a modern Linux distribution can open up, we can support here. And we have some additional hardening measures beyond simply lack of network access to make sure that that stays confined. So I've been showing you a lot of architecture diagrams. I'll here briefly now show you what the journalist actually sees from their perspective. They boot up their Cubes workstation. The first thing they see is an updater. We mandate the use of updates so that all security patches are applied before the system is accessed. That's the first thing. It will pull in all the updates, restart any templates and AppVM associations that are required, and then prompt the journalist to log into the system. So standard login form, we have a username, a password, and a second factor of authentication, most commonly TOTP. Now, critically, when this journalist performs this authentication access, action that is not in a networked context. That is something that the proxy will pick up and it will perform the authentication via the Tor connection on behalf of this client application. On login, we have a rather common conversational view here. On the left-hand side, we see a list of different conversations with different sources. And on the right-hand side is where the details of those conversations will be shown. I'm showing you screenshots from a test instance. When the journalist actually opens up, this is really the luxury of using the consolidated workstation setup. Upon opening a submission, it is viewable right here on the same screen without ferrying anything via USB to an air gap computer. You can see the title bars on these windows have slightly different colors. One is yellow, one is green. What Cubes is trying to display there is that this is a different environment. So the GUI application, the graphical application that the journalist is interacting with, when the journalist selects a submission, reads a message, and then opens a file, an ephemeral, disposable environment is dynamically created with no network access, simply in order to view that submission. And then they can view it side by side and review the material that they need, and then perhaps ask clarifying questions in real time of the source. And then importantly, when they are done looking at those submissions, that ephemeral context is destroyed and wiped from the machine entirely. So even if there was something nasty inside of them, it has no ability to interact with any other aspect of the computer the journalist is using, or exfiltrate data or interact with any other networks the journalist might be connected to. one final screenshot showing what it looks like for journalists to write back in real time, because that's what our pilot participants have been saying is really the dream of what it's like to work with SecureDrop these days. I mentioned some additional hardening measures. I can provide a lot more detail about these as warranted in Q&A. Briefly, we have AppArmor confining what's a permitted execution context for the applications. All of our templates use a custom hardened kernel. Mostly the motivation there is to mitigate memory corruption attacks, which are very common vectors to exploit a system. If you send a file type and that file is opened in a way that can exploit a memory corruption vulnerability, you may then be able to pivot and get additional access to the system. And then, of course, we use minimal templates in every context we possibly can. Winding down here, I did mention that it's very important for us to get our software solutions audited. I'm very happy to say that we've just completed a security audit of this version of the SecureDrop workstation architecture. We should have it public on the website within the next week or two. We're currently working with all the various people involved and making sure the language is all signed off on. But I will pull a quote that we got from the executive summary of the report, which is that the SecureDrop workstation system represents a complex but well-researched product that has been thoughtfully designed. In short, much of the architectural assumptions that we made in using this hypervisor-based isolation and controlling the context in which submissions can be viewed were validated by this report. So we remain quite pleased with the results and look forward to publishing it. And I very much look forward to y'all reading it and reaching out if you have any questions. So briefly, I'll say where we want to go from here. I want to transition into opening up the room, handling some questions. Some of the next steps we're hoping to take here on the project is finalizing this pilot program. We have a very small number of newsrooms that are running the workstation in concert with us. We will continue to do research with them and then improve it based on the feedback that we get. That has led already to some very specific recommendations. Those include expanding the export solutions that we provide. Signal is a common request. Signal might require the use of a phone number and be not so appropriate for some sensitive source communications. But for intra-newsroom communication, all the journalists are communicating with each other, a Signal private messaging group with disappearing messages is actually has a number of nice security properties, and we continue to recommend on use of that. Integrating that in the workstation formally would be nice. Then there's some metadata redaction, as I alluded to earlier, would be really nice to operationalize and put in a well-reviewed workflow that journalists can reapply in an automated fashion, and then continue down the research avenue. Briefly, I will say this is the team that is working so hard to put SecureDrop together. We have a few full-time folks that are working on SecureDrop at our nonprofit Freedom of the Press Foundation, and then a variety of other team members who contribute their time differently. I will now open up the floor to questions. I have certainly more to say in terms of where I think press freedom is going in this context, but I want to make sure we have time for a group discussion as well.
Well, Connor, thank you very much for your great presentation. Really, well, I watched it all the time. I didn't intend to do that, but I don't like to hijack the Q&A right now, but it will be bad for my reputation, so I'd like to keep it. And there are a lot of questions that I'd like to summarize for you, and, well, hopefully everybody forgive me if I just skip somebody. So, Omsai asked two questions. I will just skip one and ask the related one. Do the SecureDrop servers that organizations that host became honeypots for malware files? And how does SecureDrop help separate the malware from genuine files?
It's a great question. So that's part and parcel to how the internet works, right? When you're soliciting anonymous communications, you can't be sure that they're not going to be nasty. But SecureDrop was designed from day one with that assumption. We can't trust what's coming in. There might be malware there. I have, working with the project for so many years, I have seen malware come in through a SecureDrop instance. But that's what motivated the implementation of the AirGap architecture, right? If there's something nasty that's opened up on there, well, it's not connected to any other network, and it can't pivot. So the idea is, what's the point of sending malware to a SecureDrop instance if you can't actually get a pivot point, you can't get a foothold on that network and exfiltrate any data, right? Fortunately, we can do better than that with the workstation. We're actually trying to maybe get to a system that's not only more usable, but one of the research callouts we have is, you know, what would it look like if the system right now fails closed, which is a good thing. If malware sent to it, That malware can't actually do anything it was designed to do. It can't phone home, it can't exfiltrate data, it can't take over the network. Great, that's good. Well, what does it look like in the future though? Especially with the workstation, rather than just mitigating malware, what if we could detect it? Is there some other forensic operation that we could enable a newsroom like to engage with a research lab on? Some of these public studies on malware that's targeting journalists and their sources, it would be interesting to allow news organizations to participate in the discovery process there. I want to be clear, we have not implemented that and we wouldn't do it without a lot of peer review on the process, but it's something that's been on our minds in terms of this is an active threat. What can we do about it next? What we're doing now is protecting. Can we actually push back a little bit? That would be room for future work.
Thank you for your answer. Now I'm going to abuse my power. This is my question. And do you trust your hardware to keep the isolation intact with non-free BIOS, firmware, and Spectre hunting Intel CPUs? What would users practically can expect from their devices, even with secure drop?
Yeah, that's a great question. At some level, a lot of this computing infrastructure we have always boils down to trust absolutely somewhere, right? And that's often rooted at the hardware layer. So you're very right to call out the notion of firmware that's running at a layer below the software stack, which is largely what we're maintaining. Today, we make very specific recommendations about what sort of hardware to procure, A, for compatibility reasons, but also B, because we've vetted those security solutions. And one of the first steps in installing SecureDrop Workstation is making sure your BIOS is fully patched and up to date. We are still recommending the use of shipped BIOS, which in many cases is proprietary. We do have an active research issue open publicly, trying to get core boot support for the workstation. This is something also that Cubes is interested in supporting as a first class feature. We certainly have some strong opinions about what the usability of that feature versus the security controls might be, but there is fortunately active discussion on that, both in the Cubes context and in our SecureDrop Workstation Git repository. If you search for secure boot, you'll find a lot of discussion that basically is grounded in, you know, we're going to have to move toward a more Libre implementation to be really sure about what our trust model looks like at the lowest levels.
Thank you very much. And another attendee with random name asked, are you going to build a distributed Dropbox or Nextcloud or any kind of file sharing system probably?
That's a great question. What we do, I mean, in general, having worked with this organization in this space for a number of years now, I'm rather reticent to commit to taking on another big project, right? Because that's something that if it gets adopted by 75 newsrooms around the world, we're on the hook to continue maintaining. So where possible, we would prefer to reuse existing free software solutions. In terms of how something operates and whether we need to do something like collaboration, that's in large part what our current pilot program is informing us on. What we're hearing is that every newsroom is different and every journalist and filmmaker is going to have their own procedures. But largely, there's a high security context where very, very sensitive sources, perhaps paranoid or concerned sources, want to communicate completely anonymously. And that's what SecureDrop provides. As the journalist gains rapport with that source, they may switch to other methods, right? It's possible that what a conversation that started via SecureDrop will move to a different platform. In terms of the document collaboration, what we're seeing right now is the most important thing is getting sensitive information through SecureDrop safely and vetting it in a controlled, safe environment. And after that, we can have a rather open-ended export workflow. I mentioned printing to obscure some metadata associations. Copying via USB export is something that's supported today on the workstation, mandates and automates the use of an encrypted USB stick. But going from there, what other workflows do newsrooms need? It might be uploading to a shared, perhaps self-hosted document collaboration platform. But that's something that we can support probably pretty generally by allowing newsrooms to export safely to their specific environments. So it's an open-ended research question for us. But the feedback we've gotten so far is give us the ability to vet this, clean this, make sure it's safe, and then we can get it off the workstation and do what we need to do as journalists.
Thank you very much. And just a GNU, please forgive me, I will skip your question. And somebody asked about not punching. Does that specification require a middleman? How does the Tor servers remain hidden and just doing this You got me.
Great.
Go ahead.
Great question. So this is a feature that I love to call out for Onion Services because we make great use of them in SecureDrop and Long Have. We also host Onion Services for our website. So freedom.press is our organizational website. We also have an Onion URL mirroring that same site for people that want to be anonymous while browsing it. I encourage others to consider hosting the same. Yes, largely speaking, the way the Tor network operates is that there are a very, very, very small set of trusted directory servers. And so any implementation of the Tor spec will trust those directory services to get updated information about the whole swarm of Tor relays out there and then dynamically build connections out. And normally, when you're using Tor browser and you're connecting to a website such as NewYorkTimes.com, your Tor client will build a connection out to it, usually three hops, and those are randomized throughout the network. But then you're connecting to NewYorkTimes.com and your connection flips to HTTPS and ClearNet protocols that we're all familiar with. The way an Onion service works is actually building connections on both sides. So the server builds identifies a rendezvous circuit and says, meet me over there, but don't connect directly to me. And it builds its connection out three hops to that rendezvous circuit. And then the client builds three hops out. And then the pipe is established and information can flow and someone can load SecureDrop. SecureDrop doesn't really try to obscure the location of the server. It's just not really that important to us architecturally. We could theoretically reduce the number of hops that a server builds its circuit for, because if we're not trying to obscure that location, then what's really the point of those additional milliseconds of latency? But for now, we're just doing it right out of the box with how it works. Well, one thing I do want to call attention to, though, is that NAT punching prospect has all sorts of great properties for self-hosting or for Internet of Things, and it's a completely free software implementation. So there are a lot of non-SecureDrop use cases that you can use to self-host things even at home and not have to worry about any firewall rules or whitelist or ingress traffic filtering.
Well, we are using Tor Onion services to host our association's website, even though we don't need that for a static website. So, another question, I'm going to sum it up. Do you have any stats about how many whistleblowers or journalists are actually, this question is specifically for whistleblowers, but probably it will be counterintuitive to know that, do you know any stats about how many whistleblowers use that?
Yeah, so great question. When it comes to quantifying things, we have a lot of data from journalists, right? And we try really hard to make sure we understand the workflows. But we're always very clear when partnering with news organizations, we say, we don't want to know the details, right? Like there's a liability component there. We don't ever want our staff to be able to be compelled to do anything weird. And the less we know, the better. But still, journalists have been forthcoming about the nature of the work they want to do. We don't get that same luxury with sources, right? We can't sit down and interview sources because by nature, they're anonymous with the system that we've built. But I can point to some active research in this space that has done that hard digging. At secure.org/research, we've actually seen, we have some publications up there. The Charles Barrett study a couple years ago by the Tau Center for Journalism interviewed a whole bunch of news organizations that were running SecureDrop. In other words, trying to get a sense of what is the utility of this thing? Is it working? And we got a lot of really candid responses from some journalists saying there is simply no other way to get materials this sensitive this safely. So I recommend you read through that report. Again, Charles Barrett from the Tau Center for Journalism at secure.org/research. There also was another research paper looking into the impact for SecureDrop specifically just earlier this year in 2021. We've yet to add that to our research listing on the site, but there are a lot of people trying to document the utility of this in the academic space. And I would encourage folks to read up on those citations.
All right, great. Perhaps at Quest, you can mix it up with that sources. People are asking if you are going, if you will be sharing the slides. So
absolutely.
I hope you can go to IRC and just drop every link that you mentioned down there.
I certainly will. I'll be over there shortly, folks.
Okay. Another abuse of power. As you not might not know, I'm a lawyer actually, and I'm working in Turkey as a criminal justice. And I don't get to hear any SecureDrop use for law firms. And this is another part of a service that has been provided to journalists because, they are also sources to lawyers. Do you know any application of it, except me?
So great question. That's something we do conceptualize this as this is a tool for journalists, right? But clearly the use case is broader than that. It's a secure communications platform. So we have heard a lot of requests. We have heard several requests from law firms saying, hey, is this reasonable? And I didn't put it in the presentation, but in late 2019, In the U.S. Congress, Senator Ron Wyden recommended the investigation of Tor and SecureDrop specifically to be used as a whistleblowing platform for attorneys general around the United States. So in other words, this is a well-reviewed free software solution. Looks like security people like it. Looks like activists like it. Journalists trust it. It's fully anonymous. Why wouldn't we use this to solicit whistleblowing in a way that everybody can trust and be safe? So I think this shift is happening. People are starting. I will say, though, I very much look forward to the implementation on the workstation because that's such a time-saving device that I think it would be a lot simpler to have a drop-in service that we can then recommend, for example, a group of lawyers would use to solicit secure communications from their folks.
Okay, Connor, we are out of time, and I abuse my power enough. So thank you very much for this really just amazing and very informative. And IRC is just boiling right now. If you come there, probably you will be welcomed quite vividly. So thank you very much for the talk. And this is the closing statement. If you have anything to say, a last word, here's the time.
Thank you so much all for coming. It's an absolute pleasure to be here at LibrePlanet. I look forward to talking to you more in the chat room afterward. Thank you.